do a little bit of a potpourri today. I want to pick up on something from yesterday when we were talking about housing and decisions to be made. And, we gave some, we had some people talk about their living arrangements and that kind of a thing. But I got so wrapped up in those cool, innovative little things that it made it sound like, you got to have $1 million to get your house ready and et cetera, et cetera. And I just want to follow up by saying that there is a great disparity of wealth and income for seniors in the United States. And so while we have the greatest transference of wealth from one generation to the next going on in this country right now, which, by the way, development offices and most nonprofits are just working overtime. While we have that going on, we have a couple that I work with who only have their Social Security checks and a $40 a month pension. That's it. Now they live adequately. I mean, it's not wealth, and we have that kind of a contrast. And for next year, I made a proposal. We'll see if I get invited back to talk about social justice issues and seniors, because when we are dealing with that, access to housing and affordable housing is a huge issue. We all know health care is a huge issue. And even being able to pay for a funeral is a huge issue. But I will still say that by some forethought and planning, resources can be and are available to help people with housing. The United States kind of gets berated at times for some of our social programming, but really, since the 60s, there's been an increasing amount of support for seniors. And so, if you go to your county office on aging, you'll find a lot of resources that can be made available. And there's even a group family I work with, there's a grant that they got from the county to put a ramp on their house. There's just all sorts of things available. But you need an advocate, you need someone to help you work through those procedures. And so starting early, as I keep saying over and over again, gives you access. So I just wanted to mention that because there is a huge disparity in our country. But by and large, people generally, we don't have a lot of homeless seniors. We have homeless many other ages. But even the facility that I work at in assisted living, we've taken on a contract with Salvation Army and moving in homeless people who have been homeless for decades, now that they're seniors, moving into our facility, which is an interesting dynamic because they've lived on the streets, they have not had rules, and they've not had living in a community home, and they're not 21. And so they're, shall we say, set in their ways. And so as chaplain, I find some interesting challenges, because even getting along with people inside of a building where you can't just storm out and leave presents some things, but there are things available. So I just wanted to make sure we knew that. Aging is not a hopeless thing. There's some exciting opportunity. Anybody want to say anything, add anything to that? We don't have time to go into all that this week. All right. Then we're advertised to talk about dementia, so I want to do that, but I also am prepared to do a little talking. Well, let me do that first. This happens to me. Anne, can you tell us about your resource? This is on death and dying. Would you be willing to share what you shared yesterday?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so you want to, instead of dementia, you want to...
No. Un petit mot, okay? Few words, keep it tight, but tell us what happened. And let me give you this thing.
So you mean with my husband?
Right.
Yeah.
And your friend and your resource. And Thomas?
Dale.
Pardon?
Dale.
Well, thank you. Dale, I overheard you talking about a workshop or resource on death and dying.
I think that was Thomas.
Pardon?
That was Thomas.
Oh, that was Thomas?
Yeah, he's coming.
Okay, all right.
The registration.
Okay.
Maybe he knows the same one I do. Just very, very quickly, I was sharing with Steve.
I think I just wet my pants.
Whoa, sorry.
That's all right.
I had no idea it was that loud. I was just sharing very briefly with Steve yesterday about a journey that I took with my husband. In 2013, he was diagnosed with a rare neurological disease for which there's no cure. And we knew that he wasn't going to live very long. So we started on this path after we got connected with a wonderful woman in Seattle named Trudy James, who her whole focus is helping people die, preparing people to die. We took her workshop. We learned so much about dying, and it was through that workshop that that I became comfortable using the word dying. You know, at first I wasn't, but with this workshop, many gifts came from the workshop. One of which was helping us navigate this journey that we were about to take. And we learned about all different ways that that people handle this. And one of the ways for my husband was to consider the option of death with dignity. We have that law in Washington State. And he also pursued other options too, read about him, had people come in and talk to him about it, because he wasn't sure whether he wanted to live a natural death. And then ultimately he made the decision, and within 1 month he made the decision. He picked the day, the time, who he wanted there, and what it was, and how he wanted to go out. And he had a harpist there. He had his close friends there. But it was just, as these things go, it was wonderful for him, the way that he left this planet. So it's not for everybody, of course, but I think one of the beauties of exposing yourself to all the different ways that you can approach dying is really, really beneficial. And it was especially beneficial in this case for us. So that's very briefly. The woman we hooked up with was Trudy James, and she did a video called Speaking of Dying. And it's all about preparing yourself are preparing yourself or working with your parents or whoever it is on helping them have a good death, because that's what it's all about. You don't want your death to be stressful or strenuous on your family, let alone the person who is dying. And anyway, it was wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm going to share the video with Steve. I have it at home.
Thank you.
I think it is on the website now that can be watched.
I don't think so. The last time I heard it was.
Okay.
Maybe. Yeah.
Well, Dale, you want to talk for Tony? I'm kidding.
Pardon?
I said, do you want to talk for Tony?
Yeah, for Thomas?
For Thomas?
I don't know. Sorry.
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have taken this off. Anyway, I'm not, the reason I asked her to share, I thought it was a beautiful story of how one family has faced the issue. And what I basically was going, what I was basically going to start with on that is, I'm an oblate with the Benedictine community at St. John's Abbey in Collegeville, Minnesota. And so I really, I'm a Lutheran Benedictine or a Benedictine Lutheran, I don't know which way you want to call it. But one of the things that Benedict has in the rule is to say the monk should always keep death before him. And it's not a morbid, Benedict's approach is not a morbid, be depressed every day about dying. But his point is that we need to remember this life is going to come to an end. And by keeping death ever before us, his contention is it makes every day more sacred. And that it gives us an opportunity to answer our calling every day. And so in the Benedictine community, I'm also involved with the St. Paul Monastery in St. Paul. And she probably wouldn't like it if I said this, but I think it's okay. Sister Agnes has been diagnosed with both lung cancer and cirrhosis of the liver. She said it must have been too much altar wine. That's her joke. She's in her 90s. She's been a teacher all her life. She's shared with me some beautiful stories of her growing up and her faith journey. And the woman is just facing this whole thing with an incredible peace. And coming out of her faith journey, she said, you know, God has taken care of me every day of my life, and I know that God's going to continue to take care of me. So that's part of the monastic life, of keeping that before. And this one handout I've given you, it has Aging with Dignity. I used to call it this whole workshop Aging with Dignity, and I found that for many seniors the term dignity was offensive. And I'm not going to be dignified. Okay, fine, let's switch the topic. But I've got some quotes here from different people, including a meditation on death. But on the back, again, you'll remember, because we're all of that age, the song The Rose. Remember Bette Midler saying that? I don't know if other people did or not. But some say love is like a river that drowns the tender reed. Some say love is like a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love is like a hunger, an endless aching need. I say love is like a flower, and you its only seed. It's the heart of it's the heart afraid of breaking that never takes a chance. It's the dream afraid of waking that never learns to dance. It's the one that won't be taken that cannot learn to give. It's the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live. When the night has been too lonely and the road has been too long, and you think that love is only for the lucky and the strong, just remember that in the winter, far beneath the brittle snow, lies a seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes a rose. What do you hear in that? Hope. You hear hope?
Yeah.
Yeah. That seed getting ready to bloom.
Okay.
Live without fear.
Live without fear.
Or to trust.
Or what?
To trust.
To trust, yeah. I hear vulnerability. Especially in that second verse. The heart afraid of breaking that never takes a chance. But then the last line is, the soul afraid of dying and never learns to live. And to me, that's a vulnerability. It's a stretching of oneself to follow one's dream. And you know, one of the gifts, I was thinking about this morning, I have been busy since I was 14 years old. I always got myself in all sorts of activities. I started working at 16, and I was busy in high school and busy in college and busy, busy, busy. And now, I thought this morning, I have the gift of time. I have the gift of time. And when we have that gift of time, we can have the freedom to do things that we've never done before. But that's kind of an act of courage. You know, now trust me, I'm not going to take up skydiving, but a friend of mine took his 88-year-old mother out skydiving, and they went down, he didn't take her on him, but they each signed up with somebody, and I guess you get taped to them or bound to them in some way, the professional. And at 88, she jumped out of the plane and did skydiving. Why not? George H.W. was still skydiving on his 90th birthday. I mean, we have the gift of time, we have the gift of opportunity, and it can't be taken away from us. Now, maybe I'm being naive, but I think that offers some exciting opportunities. But if I get to be afraid of the future and I lock myself in my house watching Dr. Phil, you know, it's not going to necessarily happen. So, what are your thoughts?
I see it it's telling me that I need to go take a chance. And I see a conflict there, too, because it says, it's talking about seeds. Well, seeds take a while. You don't need to wait for it to bloom. You go do it now.
Okay, yeah, and especially planting them now.
Right.
And by the way, I kind of view aging, not everybody agrees with me, but this is the autumn of life when the harvest comes. And we are, in our journey, harvesting all the years of work and thinking and practice, and we're blooming. And if we're doing our jobs, I don't know if any of you read Richard Rohr, I would highly commend his book, Falling Upward, about the two stages of life. But our role now is to mentor the younger generation. So at 50, I started moving out of leadership positions and trying to spot somebody to step into it and begin to kind of encourage them to learn how to do this, to get my ego out of the way and bring in somebody new and young who can do it. That's our job as seniors. Now, have you ever noticed sometimes they don't want what we have to share? But by making ourselves available for questions, we can fulfill that role. What do you think?
I think that's a great... I work with... a lot of times I work with 19, 20-year-olds. And it just makes me happy to be around them. And they really like... They'd like to get the stage advice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so, yeah. And it's just fun to be around them.
And they like me because I'm the hippie aunt they don't have home. They kind of generate toward.
Oh, funny. There was another comment right behind you. Is that, yeah?
Well, yeah, one thing that I, you know, maybe it was Grietta, you know, Turnberry at the just watching her over the last year. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of youngsters like that. So like I feel that part of my thing now is allowing youth to mentor me.
Yes.
And not be just saying, oh, I'm the wise sage.
Exactly. They do have a lot to offer.
Yeah.
And that's the energy and that vibrancy just kind of feeds me.
Yeah, it's almost like a moral clarity or something that it helps, I guess.
And by listening, we're honoring them.
Yeah.
And truly listening, not with the intent of making them into something.
Right.
The truly listening says, I honor you and I honor what you're saying to me. And so that's part of that mentoring role. My grandson, I just got his driver's license. Simple little things. I never knew in these roundabouts, which I am finally getting a little used to, that you're supposed to signal when you're leaving the roundabout, at least in Minnesota. I never knew that. But he made sure to point it out to me while I was driving. So, well, anyway, just something to think about with that. And there's all sorts of other things to unpack with that. When I get back, I already have an appointment with the funeral director because we're going to sit down and make the arrangements. I don't want to dump that on my kids. And I'm writing my funeral service, and my kids have also asked me, since you're doing that, would you write your obituary?
Yeah,
because they said, we don't know a lot of the things that you've done. And I said, well, it's about time you find out. But, you know, I'm going to do that. It's not, I never thought I'd be doing that, but it's okay. I'm just having trouble picking the music in my funeral service, so it's not an 8-hour service. But anyway, just some thoughts on that. And that was not, oh, and then this is a blog by that same woman who wrote the one about moving and about putting her mother in assisted living. I just thought it was an interesting article for you to take a look at. And some of the emotions that go with it. And but we promised to talk about The Long Goodbye, the Nancy Reagan's book. Anybody read it? The Long Goodbye, her journey with Ronald Reagan as he had Alzheimer's and the whole journey with that. And it really is a long goodbye. How many of you have had a loved one with dementia? Okay. So you know the journey. And what we know about dementia, I have taken the training to be a certified dementia practitioner. Doesn't that sound impressive? But what we know is that we don't know. We don't know the cause. We don't know who it's going to hit and who it's not going to hit. They're getting closer to some diagnostic tools that they can tell through blood tests, various things like that. But right now, the only way to really know if a person has Alzheimer's is through an autopsy. Looking at the brain and seeing the damage. You can tell some things through an MRI. How many of you have had to take the MiniCog already? If you're a veteran, the Veterans Administration requires it for everybody 70 and older. When you go into the doctor, they give you the MiniCog, and that's where they give you the clock face, and then they say, put on there 215, or, and then you have to put the right hands, you know, where it's supposed to go. And then, I'm terrified of taking this. I know I'm getting where I'm going to have to take it. But they'll give you a series of numbers and ask you 3 questions and then come back and say, now, what were the numbers? And then another one I'm practicing is counting backwards by 7.
I couldn't do that when I was 20.
Well, there's some good cases that could, you know. Now, I watched one doctor when I was working at the hospital who came in and asked the person to name the president's cabinet. I don't know, you know. But so I thought that was not a helpful assessment. But it does really take a neurologist who specializes in dementia to actually diagnose it. And there are different levels, as you know, of dementia, depending on which scale you use. And there's early onset, most dementias begin really 65 and older. Although we are seeing more and more in the 50s and even in some in the 30s. Not many at that age, but there are 70 different kinds of dementia. Alzheimer's is the most famous of the dementias, but there's 70 different kinds of dementia. My grandmother was called TIAs, which I never can remember what that means, but they're mini strokes.
Yes, transient.
Yeah, you're getting it. And so she was slowly losing her memory and these kind of things because of those mini strokes. People get them through surgeries with anesthesia. They can be temporary dementia, or it can, depending on what's happened. You're the doctor, right? Emergency room?
No.
Who's that?
Thomas.
That's Thomas. I get you two confused. I don't know.
Well, we're pretty close. Twin spirits. You and I are twin spirits. You and I were twin spirits.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There you go. But I'm sure in the emergency room you see some of these things happening. But when we assess for dementia, you know, there's when it happens, those of you who know, people can stay home for quite a while depending on how fast the dementia progresses. And I am so privileged. For 8 years, I've facilitated a spiritual direction group for caregivers of people with dementia. And the stories break my heart. And then there's some weeks that we're all laughing so hard we've got tears running down from the laughter. Because you do get to a point in dealing with this that you have to laugh or you're going to lose it. But I have one woman got written up in the New York Times the way she's using technology to keep her husband at home. And so she has the PCAs that the state provides through funding, but she also has cameras in the home and on the doorbell so that she can even check in on him during the day to make sure he's getting good care. The attendants know this. But she also has these things that they go on his shoelaces. And I'm not quite sure how this works. But if a policeman would encounter him, because sometimes the behaviors can be a little strange, it sets off an alarm that the policeman knows that this is a person with dementia. And so they can respond differently. You can also now get like wander guards, that alarms will go off if they leave the house. You can also have a GPS pinned to their clothing or whatever, that if they get out of the house, the police can track them. So there's lots of ways with technology to keep people home longer than we used to be able to. But really, eventually, one has to face the decision of putting them in a care facility because the care just gets to be too much. And all the research shows that many times the caregiver will die before the person with dementia just because of the strain. It just, it is a long goodbye. And you're constantly grieving because every day you see something else disappear from their life. There's no way to make this sound good, except if one can embrace the journey, one can continue to love that person even in the midst. I mean, the most hurtful day, I think I've heard from people, is when they're not recognized, either by mom or dad or spouse. That's kind of a hit-the-wall day, The other day that is very difficult for family caregivers is driver's license. When it doesn't work anymore, to disconnect the spark plugs, you finally have to talk to the doctor and tell them what's going on, and the doctor's the one that takes away the license. So those are the kind of things that we go through with this. 36-hour day. Anybody read that book? If you have someone in your family with dementia, that is a book I would commend to you. It's very tedious. But the author describes what it takes as a caregiver at the different stages. And it's exhausting just to read the realities of what's coming with that. But it's really a good book. And then there was that book, I'm Still Alice. Yeah. I don't think the movie was as good as the book, which normally happens. But it really brings out executive vice president and academic dean of the university that I teach at had two doctorates, okay? Not settle for one, had two. And she ended up with dementia. You know, in her last years, she was not functioning at a very high level. So it can happen to anybody. And Parkinson's has strong correlation with dementia. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of branches, like Lewy body dementia, which comes out of the Parkinson's spectrum. I had a resident with Lewy bodies. Just love the guy. He was a brilliant inventor, and there's some kind of goggles that pilots can use to shoot rockets to fly to a certain chimney and then drop down. You know, it's very smart bomb or something, I think they call it. I mean, he invented that thing. Brilliant jazz musician, and, you know, here he was in a chair, not able to function. Of course, I learned that day that you don't sit very close to somebody with Lewy body because they have involuntary movement, and I got decked. So, I mean, I didn't get anything broken. But so this is the kind of thing that you experience and go through. Many new pharmaceutical drugs are available, but joyfully, psychotropic drugs are not being used as much because they're viewed as restraints, which is illegal to use. We can't tie people into chairs. We can't do anything that, you know, that they can't get out of, which presents certain challenges, but it's a respect for the dignity of the person. One of the things that's really happened in the field of dementia is to respect the adulthood of that person. We don't take away their dignity. And in fact, in our facility, we use the Montessori system in working with our people with dementia, which means that they are allowed to do whatever they can do. And the principle is if we take it over for them, we're taking away something that they're capable of doing. And so we are taking a whole different approach to working with people with dementia than we have in the past. Now people always ask, how do you prevent dementia? Okay. First of all, there is no cure. The only one that's somewhat reversible is vascular dementia if it's related to anesthesia, because that can become reversible. But with any other form of dementia, there is no cure and there is no reversal. It is a progressive disease that takes its toll, and for the caregiver, the term is ambiguous loss. When you lose someone to death, they're gone. With dementia, they're gone, but they're still there. and that's the ambiguous loss. And every day, something changes. And you can't even say it goes at the same rate for every person. Some people, it's very fast. Other people, it's years, depending on their physical condition. So it's a journey that requires an incredible amount of patience, but it also requires putting together a support team. You can't go it alone. And so neighbors, friends, family members have to come together as a team to provide this kind of care. And at some point, an institution needs to be brought into the process. So I think I'm going to stop for a minute, and those of you with the experience or others that have questions, let's just let's take a look at that. Yes?
I think humans are very good at separating, dividing, and naming. And people changing when they have dementia is severe, but people are changing all the time. And I know from my experience with marriage encounter, what they told me was, if you don't try to notice your spouse changing, it's going to happen all at once. And then you've got a problem. And so I think looking at that as, well, this is a lot of change, it comes down to acceptance. It's difficult. It's going to be difficult.
Yeah, it's very true. Very true. Yes?
This might be an offensive question, actually. But if a person has dementia and they know what the progression is going to be within whatever bounds there are, why wouldn't this death and dignity law come into practice? I mean, it would save all of your family from all the aggravation of having to put up with this, what we're talking about. And the person is already gone, as you already stated. So was there any thoughts on that at all?
Lynn Ann.
Well, there's lots of thoughts on that. Go ahead, Ann.
I have a little bit of experience with that. With the death with dignity, at least in Washington State, you have to have sound mind body to make a decision about that, about whether you want to pursue that as a way to end your life. And you have to be, and they will ask you when they administer the medication, are you sure this is what you want to do? And so they have to answer that positively. So when you have dementia, no, you can't. But some people deal with it, in my experience and people I've known, that they know, they're diagnosed early that they have dementia, their mother had dementia, their father had dementia, whatever, and they know that they're getting it and they see the signs. They have put a plan in place with their spouse saying that when I reach that point, so one of the ways you can die is called stopping eating and drinking, and that's what they do, is they just stop eating and drinking, and the person dies sooner than he would if he just lived it out. So there's unfortunately, I agree with you, it's a miserable death, it is. You can put in place, in Washington, there's a law that if you have dementia related to the death with dignity, you can create a statement about how you want to live the rest of your life with a dementia, and you can say, when I reach this point, I would like to have this done. And it's a law, it's a legal document, and you can never change it. Even if, 5 years from now, even if your dementia is getting worse, you are stays the same, but it's progressing, you cannot change that document, so you have to leave it as is. So and so that gives directions to the family of how to care for you once you get to a certain point. But I agree with you. It doesn't make any sense.
And if I could just add to that, I think probably a number of people know about the 5 wishes.
Yeah.
Which can be found online, but it's a document that replaces, it's a legal document in most states, not all, where you can describe a number of things about what you want, including those songs that you're talking about. But there is an addendum to the five wishes where you talk about how you want your late illness and dying to be that is specific to people with history in their family and so on of dementia.
Yeah, dementia.
So it's like a dementia. It's more than a durable power of attorney, but it's very similar to what Anne was talking about.
Out.
But it's actually a document that you can find online about sort of a...
Well, would that document preclude the family being prosecuted by withholding the food and et cetera at that point that's been designated in the document?
No, that's I've never heard of that. I mean, a lot of people choose eating and drinking, stopping eating and drinking as a way of dying. Mm-hmm. So that's perfectly acceptable. It's your choice. So, yeah, no, absolutely not.
Well, you fall into a fine line between that and elder abuse, and so that's where the laws are can be helpful and not helpful. I'm going to argue on a different side just for the sake of discussion because I'm not opposed to what you're both saying necessarily, but I love my people. The ones I work with in my and where I work, I mean, I want to retire at the end of October, but the thought of not seeing them really saddens me. Because going in there, I just come out absolutely energized. We sing songs, we play games, we color, we have, I don't know, they're beautiful people that still have a lot to offer. So at what stage, I'm going to say this harshly and I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings, but we have to ask ourselves the question, am I doing this for me or for them? I got asked that question with my brother on hospice because I kind of was advocating for a certain medication. And they said, that's going to prolong his misery. Is this for him or for you? I didn't like that question. It was difficult. So the ethics of this becomes huge. For example, do you do open heart surgery on somebody with dementia? Do you do any surgery on somebody with dementia? Do you do anything to prolong the life? Because they're not going to understand what's going on. On the other hand, I've got one, I call her my sweet little girlfriend, which is probably demeaning. But she fell and broke her neck. She's like Energizer Bunny. She's got no hood, no, what do you call those things, Colin?
Collar.
She's just, you know, going down the hallway because she can't find her jacket and she wants to go home. But she's still going strong, okay? And we have really fun conversations. She never remembers. She remembers my face from day to day, but she doesn't remember what we talked about the day before. But I guess I get scared for that because I do think they do have a quality of life that can happen. But I think there then comes a point, and that's a really hard one to determine, very hard to determine when to do something else. And
but we all have that choice. We can fill out forms saying, I don't want to be resuscitated. I don't want any.
Right.
I don't want any of that. That is our individual choice. You know, whether and it's our life, it's our choice to make.
Yes.
And it's no one else. Even though we're very sweet and loving and we have fun and all that, but it's. You know, you think, I know when my husband was dying, he was so afraid that his illness would completely bankrupt our mm-hmm. situation, because it could have. And that was one of many, not the only, motivating factors. of him choosing that because he knew it could. He could be lit for years.
I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, but I think it's individual choice on how you want, you know.
As long as it's an informed choice, which it sounds like what your husband did.
Yeah.
But I watched many family members when the patient resident starts refusing to eat. Okay?
That's her choice, yeah.
Well, the family comes in and wants us to do feeding tubes. Well, here's a reality. As a person is dying, the system's shut down. It's like turning on a computer or turning off a computer. When the body gets to the point that it doesn't want food, it won't process it. And so it clumps up inside and causes pain and it causes agony and it's not doing a thing to provide nutrition. And those are the kinds of things that people need to be informed about.
But don't you think it's worth having those conversations with your family prior? Say, I don't want any this is what I want, this is my wishes, and you've got to find somebody that you trust who will carry out your wishes.
And what did I start with on Monday? Choices.
Yeah.
Right. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Now again, there's only 8 states that have that law that Washington has. In Minnesota, we've just begun the debate. And I think I was telling you, Ann, I've changed my thinking on that over the years, drastically. But the ethics debate is still going on. And that's what we have to look at. I still would promote having good care and good quality, but your husband's illness, I'm not sure I understand it completely, was sort of a dementia-related illness. No?
Okay.
What did he have?
He had a disease called multiple systems atrophy.
My mom died of supranuclear palsy.
Oh.
And that's why we said...
It wasn't dementia at all. His disease was related to Parkinson's.
Okay.
A distant cousin.
Hers was a distant cousin as well.
Oh.
Supranuclear palsy is what hers was.
Yeah.
And just an attack. It was a neurological.
Yeah.
Well,
your body shuts down.
What we get into here is multiple questions of ethics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my point, we can't solve that today. But if I can just keep advocating for being aware of the choices that you can make. Now, some people, there is a blood test that you can take that is becoming looking like it might give you a diagnosis whether or not you have the beginnings of Alzheimer's. So now the ethics debate is, do you want to know? And many people are choosing not to know. I have some thoughts about that, you know, because I think if you know, you can, there's medicines to slow it down, you know, that kind of thing. I guess what I'm saying is people don't want to know, they don't want to deal with it. And what I'm advocating for is that you not become a victim with other people making your choices. But as Anne is saying, you have the right to make the choice, and whatever you choose needs to be respected. Now, the other ethics thing that is coming in, remember Governor Lamb from Colorado years ago advocated that anybody over 80 should not be given surgery. Let them die, because it's a drain of resources on the community. I mean, that just opens up another huge can of worms. And so in terms of ethics and justice issues, technology has been a great blessing, but it's bringing in another whole huge level of discussion about what people would say is right or not right. And I can't, you know, this is one of those things where I'm picking up my daughter's phrase again, I gotta do me, not somebody else. Now, I have specified in my health directives at what point DNR, DNI need to be taken away. But right now I'm full code, because I think there's some hope for me yet. But I have very specific, when these things happen, remove the DNR, DNR, and implement DNR, DNI. Because I want that covered. That's as far as I can go in Minnesota. But we're just faced with a lot of choices, and how we approach those, I think, makes the difference in terms of how we're able to embrace what's happening.
And just one last point I might add too, that if you're, I worry about going to a Catholic hospital, you know, with maybe, I don't need to say a lot about that, you probably understand, but they have a different values in terms of how they look at your care, especially end-of-life care, or if you're in an emergency situation. I don't want to be part of that.
In Washington State, CHI, Catholic Health Initiative, has taken over many of the community and larger hospitals. And the philosophy there is that death and dignity is the law of the land in Washington, but they won't offer that overtly to the family when the situation arises. The most they will do is point to the State Department of Health website, and so you're on your own.
Well, at least they do that.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I worry about going to a Catholic hospital and having choices on how my, you know, we're pulling the plug, those kinds of things. So.
Well, and the federal government is getting more involved in removing choice in a lot of different areas. Mm-hmm. So that's another issue. And then somebody was just telling me here, maybe it was one of you, that if you're at a veterans hospital, that goes under federal law and state law doesn't apply.
No doubt.
And so the Washington law may not be honored by the Veterans Administration because it's not federal law. I don't know that for a fact, but these are things to think about.
Yeah.
So, folks, here's the deal. We got 2 minutes left. Can't solve it today. We've raised the questions, stirred up emotions, which I hope we can forgive each other for. But if we, I just want to keep saying choices and start thinking about it earlier rather than later. Before you get into the situation, think it through. Pray about it. This is definitely a matter of prayer. It's not something to take lightly, and I know you won't. But to ignore it is not going to go away. No matter what it is, it just doesn't go away. And so we want to look at this, embrace it, and prayerfully and intentionally make choices. And we've covered a whole ton of heavy-duty topics this week, and I think what I would like to do is conclude with prayer, and I'll also leave a little bit of silence before I say amen for you to have your own internal one. How does that sound? God, we come before you with thankful hearts, thankful for aging, thankful for all the opportunities that aging brings to us, but also aware that we are called upon to make choices and decisions, and we trust your promise to guide us and direct us. Lead us to do your will and to have the courage to do that. Blessings to all who age and all who celebrate, and may your power be present among us in the name of Christ. Amen. You know, I just thought that wonderful Holden, I didn't leave the minute.
Oh, well.
I swear I hang around dementia units too long. The Holden prayer, that prayer of courage, not really Holden's, it was an evening prayer long before it was a Holden. I love that prayer. I have it on the wall of my house, but it really fits the whole aging thing. I think next week's people are going to get a copy of it. What do you think? Thank you all for holding out this this time together, and have a great evening, and whatever else you end up doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.